Welcome to InfoSecurity Magazine's monthly podcast, bringing you news highlights, topical debate, and expert interviews from the information and cybersecurity world.
You know, it's funny. Back in 2014, 2015, when I started really studying ransomware, it was entirely a technical conversation. How do you defend against it? What technical implementations do you have to use? Since then, it's grown so that now you also have to understand reporting requirements, but then also what's going on with law enforcement, because there's so much law enforcement activity in there. And now, just in the past couple of months, I feel like ransomware intelligence has turned into, and I hope this translates to like TMZ, I guess the Daily Mirror would be kind of the example, because there's so much drama going on in the world of ransomware and with ransomware actors that, you know, it's almost like having a gossip show when you talk about what's happening with them. So, you know, in very rapid succession, we've seen the Alfie/Black Cat takedown, then in January, the arrest of Scattered Spider, and then the big takedown of Lockbit by NCA. And the turmoil that's caused in the ransomware market. Now, understand, ransomware is still going strong. You know, a lot of the affiliates have moved to other ransomware groups, and we're seeing other things start to pick up. But just with those two, because they were so big and so prominent, it's really interesting to see what the effect of those pretty significant takedowns.
That was Alan Liska, ransomware researcher at Recorded Future, aka the Ransomware Sommelier, speaking during InfoSecurity Magazine's Spring Online Summit event 2024, which took place in March. Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the InfoSecurity Magazine podcast. My name's James Coker, Deputy Editor, InfoSecurity Magazine, and I'm also joined today by our reporter, Kevin Poirot. And together, we're going to dive deeper into one of the three law enforcement operations that were mentioned by Alan, who spoke at the start of this podcast. Led by the UK's National Crime Agency, the FBI and Europol, and involving law enforcement agencies across 10 countries, Operation Kronos, which has certainly been in the headlines, and it took down the infrastructure of Lockbit, which is one of the most prolific ransomware groups in the world. So, yeah, really looking forward to this chat. Hey, Kevin.
Hi, James.
So now that the dust has settled a little bit and a few weeks have gone past, we thought we'd take a really good opportunity to take a look back into the Operation Kronos and really hear from some of the experts who can give some insights into some of the behind the scenes around the operation, and also reflect on what it means for the Lockbit group and the future of ransomware going forward. In this episode, we're going to be speaking to Koryak Uzan, who is co-founder of ProDraft, a threat intelligence company based in the Netherlands. ProDraft took part in Operation Kronos, and Koryak explained to Kevin about how his company ended up alongside the NCA, the FBI and Europol. Some really interesting insights there. We also spoke to Marley Smith and Yelisei Borslowski from another threat intelligence company, RedSense. So long before Operation Kronos took place, RedSense had been investigating Lockbit for probably the last 3 years or so. And so they shared their findings right after the group's infrastructure was taken down by law enforcement. So they discuss a bit more about what they think the future holds for the Lockbit group and its affiliates, and also the ransomware as a service ecosystem as a whole. But first of all, Kevin, I just wanted to ask you a bit more context about Operation Kronos and why it is such a big breakthrough in the fight against cybercrime.
Yeah, that's right. It's been a big piece of news, and I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of it. As you said, it made a lot of headlines. But just to give our listeners a feel of how big this operation was, I'll just give a few numbers. Operation Kronos resulted in 34 servers seized, 14,000 rogue accounts closed, 200 cryptocurrency accounts frozen, 30,000 Bitcoin addresses found that were associated to Logbit, with over 500 Bitcoin addresses active, which have received over $120 million. There were also at least 3 international arrest warrants and 5 indictments. And the decryption keys to the Logbit encryptor was shared with whoever needs it and with all the victims of Logbit. So that's really, really a big operation. It's arguably the biggest in history in terms of law enforcement operation against a ransomware group.
Yeah, and it follows several other big law enforcement operations that we've covered at Info Security Magazine. But yeah, I think, as you say, this really is the biggest one. And when you consider how prolific Logbit has been in the last few years, and I think we know from the research reports that we've read here at the magazine that it's probably been the most prolific ransomware actor over the past, certainly over the past year or so. And it's been responsible for an awful lot of high profile incidents that's taken place. So as you say, I think it's a massively significant moment in the fight against international cybercrime.
Yeah, exactly. And I was really, really delighted to have the opportunity to speak to someone who took part in that operation. I spoke with Koryak Uzan. So he explained to me how and when his company ProDaft got involved in the Operation Kronos in the first place. So let's have a listen to Koryak.
So Operation Kronos was not named Operation Kronos, or in fact, it wasn't a particular this large of a task force when it started. However, especially judging in terms of our involvement or putting involvement in the case related to Logbit, which later then to be known as Kronos, I can say 2021, if I'm not mistaken, 2021 or 2022. I cannot give an exact date because Logbit was always in our radar. But I think everything, most of these investigation and most of the stuff dates back to 2021, which is the year that we have written the first Logbit reports. So first of all, in 2021, we knew about Logbit, but we were able to gain visibility into the internal mechanics of the Logbit infrastructure. Back then, ransomware as a service business model was just started picking up, and Logbit was just an emerging example. But I don't think that it was one of the priorities of law enforcement as if the Logbit today. However, I think that first investigation, our first report, was it did enable everybody to realize that, oh guys, there is something worthy of our attention today, because it already started gaining significant popularity, because back then it has something like 40 something affiliates already working on, and it was looking to be something really, really unique. And I think that started shifting the attention of people about the Logbit group. And then year after year, as Logbit changed its structure, it started gaining a lot. Logbit started spreading a lot more. More countries needed to get involved. The versions changed. The technology changed. The affiliates changed. As more affiliates started appearing more and more, more countries get involved. More critical infrastructures from different countries get involved as well. But I should say something between 2022, it started becoming a proper operation. And then as the years passing by, everybody had a lot more information about it. And it led us to here today in 2024. So it's multiple years of efforts going into this.
And Obviously, ProDraft is not the only company that has been investigating LogBit. Why were you the one or one of the companies that were involved in the later stages of the operation?
Of course, a lot of different companies contributed to the investigations a lot. But I think there may be a couple of reasons. Of course, I may be wrong about this. First, I think it was our initial report that was the first report which, I mean, globally, which put the LogBit on the scene with really internal, never before seen details about these certain threat actors. So it kind of enabled our involvement. That started with this. And then along the way, we didn't, you know, we are not firm believers of sharing IOCs and then, you know, writing OSINT-based reports. What we did was we were able to map out the biggest, the most important affiliates of the groups along the years. And also at certain stages of this entire investigation, we were able to save thousands of victims. I can safely say it, especially in the first report, we enabled law enforcement to acquire basically decryption keys of thousands of victims. So that's, I think, something significant. So, I mean, in order to sum up, I can say the acquisition of multiple decryption keys. So we saved people before being encrypted. Our ability to provide visibility for the first time in 2021 and mapping out the biggest and the most important affiliates of the group. These three factors, I think, was really great contributions in the entire operation.
And what was it like to work with law enforcement and especially work with so many law enforcement agencies?
Officially, we are we are an advisor of Europol's group on internet security. So that's officially our way of participation in the group. So and Europol is the liaison, is the proxy that enables us to communicate with so many partners. Other than that, it wouldn't be, we don't have the time, resources, or anything like that to deal with this many law enforcement on ourselves, of course. So Europol was the main catalyst in enabling this discussion. So we were able to address all the involved parties simultaneously on most of the procedure, which was very nice. And after that, of course, based on what element of the investigation that we were working on back then, we also met with liaison officers of other law enforcement as well. Working with law enforcement is always tough. And there is an ongoing investigation on LogBit is not the only matter that we are cooperating with law enforcement. I mean, it's just one of the maybe 50 different investigations that we try to do our best to contribute. But the tough thing is you need to be very careful not to damage any ongoing investigation. So deconflicting is the most major part. So we are always extra careful in not to create any confusion or conflict or interrupt with any kind of ongoing investigation on any part of the world by any law enforcement. That's one. And the tough part is not only continuing with this, the especially tough part is sometimes you have an amazing findings and an amazing report that you would like to publish, for example. However, somebody, a law enforcement agency, says that, guys, we have an ongoing investigation about a certain part of this. It touches this investigation, so you cannot publish it. We had some reports that were delayed like 2 years. Thanks to deconflicting. Some ransomware as a service groups, some malware as a service groups, for example, that we're globally talking about today. We knew about them, investigated them, had a lot to share about them for the last 2-3 years, for example, but still we're not able to publish. So I mean, in one way, it's nice feeling that you're contributing to actual, let's say, to law enforcement side of things, actual things about perpetrators, doing things about adversaries. However, from a commercial or doing what you would like to do point of view, it may be sometimes limiting. However, it comes with its territory. So,
and the way the results of the operation were presented kind of stood out from previous similar operations with law enforcement using the same codes as ransomware groups. And I think they were trying their best to control the narrative. Mm-hmm. So much so that many said that it was sort of a psychological operation as well, mm-hmm. and in which law enforcement wanted not only to take down Luxbit infrastructure, but also undermine the group's credibility within mm-hmm. the cyber criminal ecosystem. What's your view on that?
Very good question. And it's 100% a psychological operation as well, which makes a lot of sense. So I can ask you back, or we can discuss the effectiveness of just releasing one official statement and stop talking about this. So usually that loses its impact maybe the next day or a week after. I mean, the traditional approach of, you know, publishing a statement, and then it's usually gets forgotten. And also, yes, this was a psychological operation that started, I think it's the second time that we are witnessing this. In the case of Luxbit, so first of all, it's kind of like a good way to show off that you're not the only one who can mess with people's psychology. So it's kind of like creates the effect of how do you feel like the table's being turned. So that's one thing. Secondly, it's impossible. So for example, in the Opchronos, the total amount of affiliates of Luxbit is 196 different teams. So we're talking about at least 1,000 people working for Luxbit. What kind of weapons do we have in our hands? It's virtually impossible to arrest, even though you know the real identities of all the people. I'm not saying they do or they don't. I really don't know. But even let's assume that they do, it's impossible to arrest everyone. So the issue, and also there are some most countries that these individuals reside in will not also even cooperate at all. So that's 100%. So even if you do know the identities, that's out of the table. However, what you can do is one of the worst things that can happen to you in cyber underground is being marked as feds. I mean, it's short for federals, and it's short for, you know, you're cooperating with the cops. So, and this way, as when your infrastructure is this damaged, something you can do is plant the seed of suspicion to the heads of all the affiliates who are working with you. Because at the end of the day, nobody is 100% sure in the underground as well that what's the level of information currently the law enforcement agencies have. Is it only the ones that they have shared? Is it more? What kind of information about, let's say, the crypto payments? What kind of information about the actual identities of different affiliates? So these are all very important questions. And it started to get on the nerves of affiliates. And we have already seen, by the way, multiple groups or multiple affiliates start moving away from Luxbit to find themselves some other ransomware as a service parties, or start being active on their own. So this is a psychological operations approach, and it works.
Many were also disappointed by the who is Luxbit SUP entry, since the identity of Luxbit SUP was never really revealed. What can you say about this? Do you think they have the identity and cannot reveal it yet, or do you think they kind of tried to call Luxbit SUP's bluff?
That I cannot comment. But as a general idea, I can say that What's being shared on the entire OpChronos page is a very small partition of what's already available in terms of acquired information. Sometimes they already, this entire operational group already, they managed to show that they had significant amount of information. After a certain point, it may also become counterproductive from the future of your investigations as well, but not in terms of who is Lockbit sub, but in terms of other aspects of the operation that I know of, I can say that it's usually very limited portion of the available knowledge. So I think it may be applicable to the question of who is Lockbit sub as well.
So great insights there from Koryak and well done securing that interview, Kevin. I thought it was fantastic to see the growing effectiveness of the collaboration that we're seeing between cyber companies with threat intelligence, information and law enforcement, and really seeing the impact of that kind of collaboration. It was something that was also discussed at the Online Info Security Magazine Online Summit that we mentioned at the start of the podcast. We had a keynote address by Ivo Di Carvalho Peixinho, who is head of the cybercrime unit at the Interpol Cybercrime Directorate during the summit. You can catch that session on demand via our website. I thought it was great to see about this improving and stronger collaboration.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we've been covering law enforcement operations for a long time now, and I can see that the importance of the private sector and like threat intelligence companies and other cybersecurity companies are growing in these operations. I think there were at least three different private sector companies who took part in Operation Chronos. Sometimes it's just one, sometimes it's one or two, and there might be other ones behind the scenes as well. So we can see that the private sector and the collaboration between law enforcement agencies and the private sector is growing, and it's probably also allowing such broad scale collaboration, such broad scale operations. But what I was really interested in what Koryak said, and kind of surprised as well, is that he said that ProDaft was not really interested in publishing public reports on threat actors, and this is something that we cover a lot, like those reports, the threat intelligence reports from threat intelligence companies. He was saying they're not really in the business of doing that much. They'd rather keep things secret and share it with law enforcement. So it really shows that this field is quite diverse, with many companies sharing everything they find to the public. And I think that's really important to do that as well. And others are more working in the dark and sometimes sharing their critical insights with law enforcement, and sometimes that can also help not to reveal everything.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point to make, and I think with threat intelligence as well, it's always important to recognize there's different types of threat intelligence, and different companies can specialize in different areas. And as you say, it's important that I guess some parts of it aren't made public, and especially when tracking these international cybercrime groups over a long period. I think it's a real testament to the sort of collaboration and work we're seeing in this space in the past few years, and long may it continue. I thought another interesting aspect of the operation's success that was discussed in the interview was also the fact that it was a psychological operation as well, which I thought was a great insight. What was your thoughts on that, Kevin?
It's something that has been reported quite a lot. I think we've mentioned this in our articles as well, and that kind of resonates with what Marley Smith from Red Sense told me before the interview that you will hear later. She was pointing to the fact that this psychological aspect, including a message, because the law enforcement agencies have shared a message saying that Lockbit's kingpin, which is known by his persona Lockbit Sup, was engaging with law enforcement. And this psychological aspect and the fact that they say, oh, the kingpin of this ransomware group is working with us or has engaged with us at least, is really undermining the group's credibility within the cybercrime ecosystem. And I think that's a really big part of this operation as well, to try to kind of make people behind the Lockbit group lose trust, or people in the cybercrime ecosystem lose trust in the Lockbit's admins. Now, what does Operation Kronos mean for the future of Lockbit? That's a question that I'm asking, and that's the question that a lot of people in the cybersecurity community are asking. So up until the last week of March, the alleged comeback of Lockbit, who have made a new data leak site since the takedown, who also claimed a few new victims. Up until the end of March, a lot of cybersecurity professionals were saying that it was fake, that the victims that they've shown seemed to come from malicious campaigns conducted before the takedown. But now, it seems like some of the victims might be, and I'm saying this with a pinch of salt. Nothing has been confirmed, but it seems like some of the victims may come from operations or malicious campaigns that have been conducted after the takedown. So it's really, really too early to say what Lockbit is going to become. But I did ask Marley Smith and Yelisei Bohuslavsky from RedSense to share some educated guesses on the future of the group based on their own investigation. Let's hear what they can tell us.
Well, with Lockbit, it is interesting because Lockbit's affiliates on paper, like the technical Lockbit affiliates, there were thousands of them with a very low entry barrier, of most of them like contributing, I would say, little to nothing to the actual group's operations. And in terms of like the high level affiliates that are sort of like worth chasing after, as we've talked about in our own research, are the affiliates of Xeon, which Lockbit was essentially using as a ghost group in order to conduct operations. Like, that is sort of the ultimate goal of these takedowns of like, it's essentially like, let me put it this way. For groups that are working with a ghost group such as Xeon, such as Lockbit or Akira, essentially the goal of them is to cut off the supply of work that Xeon is able to have access to, because it is in these situations a little bit more difficult to like the ghost group model is set up in a very sneaky and particular way. And with Xeon, the aspects of that Xeon handles versus the aspects that the affiliate group such as Lockbit handles, the things that are able to be deconstructed and taken down almost entirely exist within the affiliate group. So that would be their blog, the negotiations, the locker, which is able to be decrypted, anything solid essentially is going to exist primarily on the side of the affiliates working for the ghost group. So essentially the best method, because it is going to be an extremely complex situation to actually, you know, conduct a physical raid or make arrests, such as in the case of like what they did with Arevil a few years back. A much simpler way to slowly wear down on the larger affiliate processes is to essentially like cut off the arms of the organization and make them extend a lot more effort in order to get things back to standard zero, essentially.
And maybe to just rewind a little bit on some of the things that you've touched on, you have investigated the Logbit ransomware group long before Operation Kronos was announced. What are some of the key findings you can share with us, notably touching on the Xeon Ghost group? What is a ghost group exactly, and maybe other findings that you've shared with in the results of your investigation?
Great. So I think that if we just start from something recent when it comes to Logbit, post the law enforcement takedown, we did notice, obviously, with the case of the Georgia documents, just instances of Logbit sort of making these claims of attacks that were not can be considered like invalid, and this is something that is not surprising for a group that has recently like experienced a law enforcement takedown. But it's also something that we have noticed with the Logbit group for a couple of years now. I think back as early as early 2022, maybe even 2021, we were noticing on the Logbit blog just instances in which Logbit would repost third-party data which was stolen from certain attacks as separate attacks, pretending that they weren't like new attacks. We saw instances in which they would publish things like empty file directories and claim that they had data published on their blog when in fact there was nothing there. We saw instances in which there was just like blatantly reposted information claimed as new attacks. And if you remember back during this time period when Logbit was really, really prolific in the media, there would be instances in which it would say things like Logbit claims, you know, 50 new attack victims in one day or something like that. Those types of numbers just aren't feasible in a system of like tracking legitimate advanced operations. There has to be some cutting of corners there. And in the case of Logbit, there was a lot of cutting of corners. And in terms of the ghost group operations, our company RedSense discovered via internal visibility into like the infrastructure of these groups. So ghost group, essentially, I decided to coin that moniker. I hope that it was original and that I didn't just accidentally steal it from something.
I've never seen that, that concept and specifically that terminology. So I think you legitimately coined it.
Cool. So I decided to name it essentially after the concept of ghostwriting, when authors write books for other authors and just let them sort of take it under their own name. And that's what a ghost group is. It's when a ghost group, in this case, Xeon, is essentially conducting pen testing and advanced operations for groups and sort of letting them take the credit for it. And this is done because essentially Xeon is able to get a hefty, steady stream of income from these operations, and they hold way, way less risk of being shut down by law enforcement, as we can see from the Logbit takedown. So essentially in these operations, Xeon is going to provide its own, you know, pen testing abilities and initial accesses. The affiliate groups such as Logbit and Akira are going to supply, you know, locker, blog, negotiations, any kind of public data publishing. In this way, Logbit is actually very, very good at what they do. They have, ever since the release of, say, Logbit 3.0, like really had a handle on their public image. For how chaotic Logbit's up is, he's very, very entrenched in like media relations, and their blog is honestly the nicest looking data publishing blog that I've ever seen. Back when it was fully operational, they had all these nice little animations, and they had like a searchable directory, as well as like a really nice like layout design and everything like that. I think they even had like a way to pay cryptocurrency directly through their website. And so Logbit honestly was an ideal affiliate in this case because they did have the Logbit Locker, which was very notable, especially at its time of release, for being like a quality locker builds, and they just didn't have the pen testing initial access capabilities in order to get high profile successful attacks that would net them payments. And so this was sort of almost like a perfect storm in terms of relationship between two groups. And this has been something that has been developing since 2021, actually. So once those actors were connected after Conti originally dissolved as a larger syndicate, things have sort of just been building from that point. And they've sort of maintained this like ongoing relationship that has also managed to connect Lockbit to a number of Xeon's other affiliates, which really only serves to entrench Xeon further into the threat ecosystem at large, for both groups, actually.
What's interesting in your findings, I feel like, is that it kind of like takes the narrative of ransomware as a service kind of upside down, as in we tend to think that it's usually a group of high skilled people running a group and relying on lower skilled people. And I feel like this ghost group finding, the fact that you found that some ghost groups like Xeon are actually quite high skills, and that they are kind of like not selling, but at least renting their names and their skills over to another brand, if I may say. How did you come up with these findings? What led to maybe briefly, what led to find such the existence of such groups?
We began investigating Lockbit, actually not as our core investigation, but as an investigation that was related to our central investigation into Conti. And at some point in 2021, and then further in 2022, we started to see that there is this like massive operational bleed out from Conti into Lockbit and from Lockbit into Conti. And at the beginning, I didn't even think about it that much, because 2021, 2022, especially the beginning of 2022, those were the months when Conti was expanding pretty aggressively. They were doing this hostile acquisitions. Hive would be the most classical scenario, when they just pretty much came and, like, you know, ate the entire group. Quantum, the original Quantum, which was you know, the group that was behind MountLocker and AstroLocker, like, they consumed them the same way. So it wasn't really too surprising to see this, you know, bleeding of talent into Lockbit and then back from Lockbit into Conti. But then it became like pretty manifested, because it was clear that this relationship was becoming strategic. And the pinnacle here, the milestone here, was when Lockbit essentially developed a version of their locker which was adjustable for Conti. And because, like, Lockbit line of lockers and Conti line of lockers, like, there were different Contis within this, like, old school. Ryuk, their original locker, was like 2017, 2018. And that's when we started to see that this ecosystem is actually extremely interesting. And at the same time, we started to see initial access brokers complaining that they don't want to work with Lockbit anymore, because around the summer of 2021, Lockbit was pretty much taken down. The admin was taken down, allegedly, by the Russian government and replaced by, you know, either like himself, but already reporting to the government, or, like, you know, by someone who is using the persona. And this was exactly the time when Lockbit SUP became extremely active and extremely vocal. So we started to see this, like, diversion of operations. One very silent, with big emphasis on Conti, and the other one very public, with big emphasis on Lockbit SUP, but no real operations behind that. And that became a very interesting scenario. And 2023 was when we started to go for Lockbit in a very particular way, because at this point it became clear that what is going on between Conti and Lockbit is essentially the archetype, a new paradigm for the entirety of the threat ecosystem for 2023, because now it's just a mess. Everyone is working with each other. Everyone is deploying each other's lockers. And we were just trying to, like, navigate those waters. I think, like, in understanding this ecosystem, it's more than just analytic curiosity. I think the main thing here is the predictability. And specifically with the ghost groups, when we saw that LockBit was taken down, my immediate thought was that Xeon is also working extremely closely with Akira. Akira is, in a way, you know, one of the creations of Xeon. And it was pretty obvious that after LockBit is down, those Ghost Group pentesters, they would merge with Akira in an even more advanced manner. And we alerted the community. We said that there would be an increasing threat from Akira, and that has absolutely manifested. Like, we're seeing, especially on the incident response side, we're seeing this entire like wave of high profile attacks from Akira, and some of them end up on Akira blog, but this is actually a minority. The majority are not reported because the victims are deciding to pay. That's really what makes Ghost Groups so silent and efficient, is because they're very high skilled and they can actually perform successful attacks that never end up in blogs or anywhere beyond, you know, law enforcement records or incident response records. And Akira is going through this, like, you know, silent but like very devastating, formidable move now by acquiring those people who used to work from Xeon to LockBit.
So what's going to happen with the LockBit now that the Operation Kronos has taken down at least a large part of its infrastructure? Is the brand going to die down, or is the person or the people behind the ransomware group going to make a comeback, as they've already claimed they have? They've listed a few new victims on their data, on a new data leak site, for example.
In my opinion, if they're going to rebrand slash reboot in any kind of way, it would be after laying low for a significant amount of time, coming back under like an almost entirely different leadership. And at that point, really, like, calling it LockBit is mostly just like would be a name only. We've seen ransomware groups do like take this tactic before and essentially just adopt the name and persona of a previously existing group that is now dead in order to, you know, maintain that lineage and claim a like longer heritage of attacks to make themselves seem more legitimate. But I personally don't see LockBit in its like current actual form continuing to exist past this point in any meaningful or significant way. Just based off of the person going by the moniker LockBit Sups, personality and sort of like his interactions with the media, he does seem to, you know, enjoy the public attention of being in the spotlight for these reasons. So I wouldn't be surprised if he comes back in some other form to, you know, make headlines again, but I really don't think that he is going to be a major player in the ransomware ecosystem in any kind of actuality.
And what does it mean for the future of ransomware as a service, especially these findings around the existence of ghost groups? Are we seeing a shift from the ransomware as a service model that we knew to a different one?
Yes, absolutely. And I would say that ransomware, as we have been defining it for the last couple of years, is in late stages, dying form. I think it is not even controversial to say. Like, essentially, things have just shifted so much within the ransomware landscape, the ransomware ecosystem, and have just become so unrecognizable from what they've been for the last couple of years that it's difficult to even call it that anymore. But for simplicity purposes, like, we can still, you know, refer to it as ransomware as a service. But what we're seeing is a major shift towards initial access, using the use of initial access brokers and ghost groups and all of these sort of like supplementary actors that are essentially the outsourcing of certain forms of labor required to conduct attacks on large and established companies. We're also, you know, seeing an increase in using vulnerability exploitation as opposed to, you know, picking and choosing targets and doing elaborate pen testing operations. Just because cybersecurity has developed in such a quick way to match hackers' abilities that essentially, like, exploiting 0 days and really hopping on the forgetfulness and or failures of victims to, you know, keep all of their stuff up to date is really like one of the biggest open doors that they're able to access at this point. Things are very messy in the threat landscape right now. And honestly, it hasn't even gotten close to what I would consider to be a rock bottom for the threat landscape. Like, things still have a long way to go of like dissolving and becoming increasingly muddled and confusing, and us seeing the public breakdown of any kind of established groups. And I think that we're just going to continue to see that in the future. Last year was a huge year for like ransomware takedowns. I think that things are leading to this domino effect where all of the baseline foundational structures are slowly falling down, and things are essentially sort of being held up by these shims that ransomware actors keep relying on, which is, you know, scare tactics, novelties, utilization of pre-existing methodologies and relationships between groups. The ransomware ecosystem, as it's trying to exist now, I don't believe is sustainable, because it's trying to build off of something which is not stable and lasting, essentially. It's not a foundation at all. So I think that we will just continue to see an increasing maelstrom of chaos throughout 2024, especially since, given that this is an election year, there's going to be a lot of misinformation occurring, a lot of very public breakdowns, and a lot of general confusion as the system sort of like folds in on itself, essentially.
Really interesting reflections there, and I think a lot of food for thought for our listeners to take on board and reflect, really, particularly Marley's and Yelisei's predictions for the future of ransomware, as I think our viewers will know, is increasing and probably reaching record levels in 2023. So yeah, we'll certainly be continuing to report on the evolving threat landscape, including ransomware, this year and beyond. That's all we've got time for today. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you very much to Kevin for joining us. And also a huge thank you to Koryak Kuzan, Marley Smith, and Yelisei Bobolowski for taking the time to speak to us. Until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the Info Security Magazine podcast. For in-depth interviews with the industry's leading experts, check out our sister podcast, where we sit down with a cybersecurity expert to discuss the hottest topics of the day and their personal journey into cybersecurity. And of course, for more news, analysis, and expert insight, head to the Info Security Magazine website at infosecurity-magazine.com.